Hello and welcome to Changing the Record, the podcast brought to you by the Talking About My Generation news team, who are setting the record straight on growing older in Greater Manchester.
Hello, I'm Reverend David Gray and I used to be the ape keeper at Bellevue.
So firstly, what are your earliest memories? Because you're from North Manchester originally and you must have gone to Bellevue when you were younger. So what were your experiences at Bellevue growing up?
Okay, first off was hearing of it, and anyone who spoke of it in relative awe. I remember my father, during one of his periods of leave, he was in the Navy, talking about having gone to spend time with the guerrilla, and I was just like, we've got to go to this place. And then, of course, as I got a little older and I was able to walk, we'd either get the 53 bus up Queen's Road to Bellevue, or we'd walk it. And kids didn't complain about walking that distance and walking all around the place to get there. So my earliest memories are going with Mum and Dad, picnics, you know, taking a picnic lunch, just generally still visiting regularly. In my youth, it was the sort of place, you know, you'd go with other young people. Yeah, I've known it all my life in a way. I was fascinated by animals, so the zoo was the big draw for me. I liked the fairground, but I actually worked on the fairground as a kid. I didn't know when I was a child that my father had grown up on a fairground. It was, you know, the war had come along, he'd joined the Navy, he'd met my mum, who was a Wren, and the course of his life had changed. But in the school holidays, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and seemed to have the right approach. I think I was about 9 the first time, and I was running a kid's ride for someone at Heaton Park. The fairground at Bellevue was great. It just felt like it was just natural. I suppose it was one of those things that's so familiar you take for granted, if you know what I mean. So the zoo was really important. I do remember the floral clock fascinating me as a kid. I couldn't understand. Now I can look back and think, oh, it's dead simple. You've just got some kind of a mechanism, a motor. It's buried in the ground in some kind of protective shell, and the floral clock tells the time. But it was fascinating that this floral clock, which was part of the gardens, was there then. I remember so many things, and one of the things that fascinated me was they used to bring like a massive fireman's ladder that seemed to reach into the clouds. And then they'd make a fuss, and they'd usually do this on a busy time, like a bank holiday when there were lots and lots of visitors. And then they'd have someone measuring and pacing the ground towards a washing up bowl. And they'd put a small amount of water in it, and then they'd tell you, on Wednesday at 11 o'clock, Marvo the Magnificent will leap from that ladder into that washing up bowl. And of course, the crowds came to see it. And sure enough, Marvo would leap. He'd hit the bowl and it would slide. And then they'd phone the ambulance. But it brought in the crowds. Or sometimes it was a tiger jumping off the ladder. But I mean, with the tigers, there was definitely no danger. You know, the tiger itself was the attraction. So it was just a place that was really, really magical. And I remember going there in my teens. I was always fascinated by, I think people called it the fairy castle. It was just a stone kind of a folly, for want of a better term, that kids could climb over. It had little turrets and pinnacle towers and minarets, and there was flea circuses, there was a waxworks. You could go and you could record your own, which was great in the 50s. You could go to Bellevue and go into a booth and record your own voice singing your favourite song, and it'd come out on literally the first floppy disc. It was just a very thin layer of plastic. It was a great place.
So the world really came to Manchester in terms of the offering there, and people were more than committed to their art there in terms of showing off what they could do when they were at Bellevue.
I always thought Bellevue's a place where giants and dwarves are equals. The weirder you were, the more likely you were to make a living there. And of course there were freak shows and all of that, but people actually wanted to earn a living. But the guy that kind of sticks in my mind, there was that booths used to set up, and there were always new ones, and there were always the old familiar ones. But one day, when I was working there, there was an African guy who wore a grass skirt, had a box frame that he broke lots of broken glass into, and then pretended he was going into some kind of a chant. So he was playing on racist stereotypes, really. And then people would pay a shilling or whatever to come in and see him. And he'd dance up and down on this broken glass. And then, you know, everyone would file out going, whoa, that's amazing. And then I'd see him in the back pulling the glass out of his feet going, oh, oh. But the guy made a living. I mean, Houdini came there. Bing Crosby, the Rolling Stones, The Who, the great acts of the day played there, television personalities, particularly those involved in zoology, like Johnny Morris and Desmond Morris, who were big names in the day. And Bellevue took part in things in the community. So, for example, llamas would walk in the Lewis's parade. So, you know, the department store's parade in the city. There might be camels, sometimes elephants. So it was part of the life of the city. And it was great for those living in Gorton, as my wife did. They would see an elephant walking down Hyde Road with just strolling along with a guy. And it'd go to the baker's, put one foot on the step, the door would open, a customer would usually open the door, it'd put its trunk in, the baker would give it a bag of buns, and it would turn round and walk back, and everybody knew it was going to share the buns with its mates back at the zoo. But of course, what we didn't realise then was the plight of the animals. And that was something that really dawned on me much later on. But I will say about that, it was wrong that our ancestors brought animals into the breeding stock and into captivity to be curios for human beings. However, the descendants of those animals can't now just simply pick up where they left off, just as people can't pick up the horticultural skills that they left behind during the Industrial Revolution. Those animals need to be honoured. They need to be respected, not in small cages, not just there for curiosity. But if a zoo is not working in rewilding, you know, keeping species sustainable, then really it shouldn't be there. It shouldn't be there. And the ideal, one of the things that we've done, you talked about Bellevue being a regional resource, we wrote a business plan based on Bellevue. We included an idea that was picked up by Chester Zoo, which has always been one of the better zoos. And what Chester Zoo have done is bought massive amount of land. So the zoo's grown threefold, or the area has grown threefold, and two-thirds have been developed into a massive lake with islands. So you can get a boat, you can go and you can, you know, you can go to the souvenir shops, you can go and get a coffee or something to eat, but you can drift past an island where elephants are minding their own business, just having, you know, a good time in a much more natural environment. Obviously, they still need some human intervention for food and healthcare and so on. And they haven't got the range that they have in the wild. But it's far more wholesome for them than being, you know, just in a concrete area on display to the public.
If we start with your experience working at Bellevue, then at what point did you feel like you wanted to to work at the Zoological Gardens, and what was your experience like there?
Oddly, I was working in mental health. I was training in psychiatry and psychology, and one of the things I was asked to do as a 19-year-old student was a study of, the patients on a given ward as to what made them anxious. So I devised a questionnaire like you do, and I'd sit in the day room with them, or I'd sit on the edge of the bed and I'd ask them the questions, you know, about the things that got them anxious. And one of the consistent answers was, I'm really worried about my dog, my cat, my parrot, whatever, that my neighbour, my family member is currently looking after. I haven't seen it for, you know, since I was admitted. And I'm really missing it. So back in those days before mobile phones, get into the office, sit down with them, phone whoever was looking after the dog, and they put the dog on the phone. And did I think this was crazy? No, I didn't. I'd grown up with dogs and I totally got it. And the person's well-being that day improved. We even started taking them home, and then I worked with another guy called Ken Barnes, who became a councillor in North Manchester, who was on a similar kind of way of thinking around horticulture and re-engaging. So we managed to persuade some of the nurses living in the nursing home to hide the dogs, the cats. They weren't supposed to have pets in there, so that the patients could have regular contact. And what started to happen was, we persuaded wards to, instead of just having rows and rows of beds in the dormitory end and a day room that was just seats all around and a television somewhere, we persuaded them, get some fish tanks in. And Ken said, right, let's start a small holding. And so at the back of a couple of the wards, we had a small holding where patients were involved in growing fruit, vegetables. There were chickens, there were rabbits, there were goats. And the thing that kind of really made me click, and I did my third year basic, my nursing assessment, based on the quality of life that people get from contact with animals. And I took people to Bellevue and I took them to farms, and we had big discussions that were very pertinent to people who were on the cusp of being institutionalised, about whether animals should be in cages or not, and so on. So it was really a very fruitful undertaking. But the thing that clicked it, I came on duty one morning and I went onto the veranda of the locked ward, the ward where the wisdom of the day was the people who are on this ward can never go into the community because they're a danger to themselves or to others. And at the back of that ward was where we had the small holding. Now, there was a guy on the ward who paced up and down, ironically, like a caged lion. He wouldn't even sit down for meals. He knew where his plate was. He would take food from his plate and walk, eating it, and then walk back. He wouldn't look at anyone. He wouldn't talk to anyone. And yet this guy had been a very successful sportsman, a very articulate human being. There clearly various issues going on. He was a challenge. Everybody wanted to know, how can we reach him? And what happened this morning when I'd gone in, I was on the veranda and I could hear someone gently talking, and I looked down and it was him. And he was milking a goat. And he was talking to the goat as he milked it. And I knew he was on holy ground. There was something very special going on. So rather than go up to him, which I think would have totally ruined the situation, I walked around and started to let the animals out the way you would, you know, get the chickens out, feed them some grain, that kind of thing. So that I was naturally coming back towards the ward, on line with him. And as I got close, I knelt on the other side of the goat and I was talking into its other ear, saying, "Hey, you're all right, lad." And then I felt this warmth on my forehead. And you know, like you do when you know someone's looking, someone, sometimes it's the back of your neck when someone's watching you. And I looked up and I had total eye contact with him. And I said, fresh milk. And he said, brew. That's all he said. And we got up, we walked into the ward, we made each other a brew. And when the rest of the team came on duty, they were absolutely mind blown that he was sat in companionable silence, just drinking a brew. That was the first stage in his rehabilitation. So clearly I was onto something, and I knew I had to get closer to more variety of animals. And the one place I knew I could do that was Bellevue. So I went to see Peter Grayson, who was the manager at the time. I was still not qualified as a nurse. And I said to him, Peter, this is my experience. And he said, well, do you know, very often people come here who are traumatised, who've got mental health issues, and they just like to be with the animals. And as we get to recognise them, we let them in free, because they're not doing anything other than watching the animals. So I said, I'd love, once I qualify, to come and work here. He said, I know exactly the job. Will you work with the great apes? Well, it was mind-blowing, because it took me right back to my dad talking about it, having had met the silverback gorilla when he was on leave, because he had a mate who worked there or something. I qualified, and he almost immediately, because I knew that Bellevue was coming towards the end of its life, I left nursing, took a massive... I went work for about a quarter of what I was earning as a qualified psychiatric nurse, and went to work at the zoo. And each zookeeper had bird sections, so I had raptors like owls, kestrels, water birds, cranes, flamingos, that I was responsible for, game birds like pheasants and so on. So obviously we were busy. Every keeper of whatever, you know, the cat keepers, the bear keepers, we all had birds that we were responsible for. So Wednesdays was the big day. That was the day that I was totally working with the apes. I'd be working with them, you know, in terms of feeding, mucking out. But I'd also, when I was looking after the birds, I'd often have Topaz and Daisy. Daisy was a two-year-old chimpanzee, and she'd sit with her legs around my neck, holding on to my ears, and Topaz would sit on the hip, and we'd go around the zoo, and we used to collect eggs. So we'd find, obviously, we'd find chicken eggs, we'd find goose eggs, we'd find all sorts of eggs, and we used to bring them back to the ape house, and Topaz and Daisy would come down as we, and we'd put them in the incubator. And every morning when I got them up, they would go rushing down to the incubator and turn the eggs very, very carefully. And some of the birds that hatched fixated on the chimpanzees. So whenever I was walking round the zoo, birds were following us because the chimps were still with me. So it was a magical time at many... And, of course, I understood Pavlovian conditioning and all that from my training, but there was still, nevertheless, for all there were, you know, explanations, there was something sheer magic about it. You got to know the temperaments. For example, Jojo, the silverback male gorilla, and Susie, the female, they were lowland mountain gorillas. And... basically, he seemed to be a bit kind of domineering, for want of a better way of putting it. So he would take the best food. So what I did was I'd wait till Susie was up the pole, as it were, and I'd show her where I was hiding food, so that she could sneak and get some of the better stuff. So we were building a kind of friendship and understanding. Jojo clocked one day and started to do, you know, the mock charge, chest beating, whenever he saw me. Yeah, 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 hitting on my woman. But Jojo got it in the end. Just as people use Latin in medicine and horticulture and botany and so on, working with primates back in the 1970s, the language that was used was American Sign Language. So I was expected to not give a... If, say, Daisy or Topaz asked me for an apple, they had to ask, like, you know, make the sign for apple. And I'd give it them, and I'm thinking, hang on, this is the Englishman abroad. We're supposed to be the clever ones. It just didn't seem right. One of the things we were studying then, and I've only studied in humans since, we weren't looking at it in relation to humans, but zoologists were looking at, why is it that a newborn animal instantly knows the basic rules that it's got to lay downwind, keep quiet until it's got the strength to move about on its own, stay close to its parent, whatever, whatever. How does it know all that? And how does it know certain other things as it grows? For example, apes in captivity intuitively react. If they've never seen a snake, if they see a toy snake, they will react and back away. So there's something that we called at the time racial memory. When I say we, I mean the zoological world. We knew that they knew things that their ancestors knew that they couldn't have learned in their particular span. So one of the things I knew was that every ape in captivity, or virtually every ape in captivity, had a female ancestor who was shot so that her young could be captured and brought into the breeding stock. So one day, Susie's not well, and I'm realising she's got something akin to a flu virus, something like that. The zoo vet, David, was at Blackpool, so he wasn't available. So for all my kind of human medical training, I wasn't allowed. But I phoned him, and I said, Susie's got these symptoms. I think she needs this antibiotic. I'm willing to start the treatment because the last thing I want is for anything to happen to her. Will you sign the paperwork when you get back? And he said, I will. You've got spot on. Go and give it her. And I said to him, OK, how do I administer it? He said, if you look in the food prep room, there's a cabinet above the wall. In there, there's a tranquilizer gun. Shoot her, pour the antibiotic down her throat, do that 3 times a day. And I thought, it's not happening. And I was in a meltdown. I thought, I can't do that, but she needs the medicine. So what I did was I left a trail of fruit for Jojo, got him outside so that she was on her own in the sleeping quarters. And I was leaning on this metal door where there was a Judas hole, looking at her. And I closed my eyes, and it was really cold, the metal. And I remember thinking, I've got the medicine, I've got a spoon. And I remember thinking, Susie, I want to come in. I don't want you to be poorly. I want to make you well. And I know that you've got every right to rip me apart if I come in there after what my species has done to yours. And then I felt this warmth on my head. And it was just like when the person I was referring to earlier was milking the goat. And I opened my eyes and she'd gone to the far end of the room and she'd sat, I can only describe it, like a great furry Buddha looking at me. She didn't say a word, but she communicated to me, I know you want to help me, come in. I still wasn't sure. I opened the door, I pushed it to behind me, locked it. I walked over, put the medicine on a spoon, and as I got up to her, she just lifted her head and opened her mouth and sucked it in. And I backed up, and then I did that again. And the third time that I did it that day, I turned around to walk out. And at that moment, this massive arm came on my shoulder, gently spun me round, and we were looking at each other. And she communicated to me in that look, "We're not here because of the bars. We're here because of your species misunderstandings. We're here because of your prejudices. Thank you for trying to help." And then she got better. And every day after that, I was going to all the apes and looking at them and trying to get eye contact. And when are you going to speak to me? When are you going to communicate like Susie has? And that led to so many things in a short time that if I could explain it in a way that people would understand, it's massive interspecial empathy. You see it with vets, with dogs. They don't necessarily say anything, but their whole demeanour, their body language is, look, I know you're scared, you don't know what's happening, I want to help you. And you hear so many stories of wild animals that have been helped by a human, or of wild animals increasingly that will approach humans. So koala bears were coming to firefighters during the bushfires in Australia for water. The goats were coming off the Orme during COVID and into into Llandudno because the people weren't about. But trying to explain it to people, back then they thought you were mad. However, something happened that changed that. And what happened was a gorilla called Binti Jua was minding her own business in an outside pit with other gorillas, when someone holding their child above the pit slipped and the child fell into the pit, landed on the grass and was stunned. Binti Jua came over and put the child in the recovery position, kept all the other gorillas at bay, just as a first aider would do. And she knew that the zookeepers were on their way, but they would be armed. And what she did was lift the child, carry him to the door, lay him down, and as she heard the key in the lock, she went away. He's yours now. And everybody saw that. So suddenly, people had tried to tell who were going, "You're mad, you're an absolute nutter, you are," would say, "I remember you telling me, you know." And that's when I thought, at last, and it was particularly my Franciscan, I'm a Franciscan, so my Franciscan group said, "You need to write the stories down." So eventually I did. It became a little book that we used to raise funds for the monastery. It's available on Amazon. And that led me to writing other books in all sorts of genres. It was so amazing that eventually human beings had enough information to go, "Oh, maybe there's more." And of course now, you've got Greenpeace, you've got animal rights activists, you've got all these organisations who totally get the web of life is vital. We need to understand it and we need to respect it, and we're just part of it. We're not at the top of some kind of hierarchy.
So your experience at Bellevue has obviously informed a lot of what you've done since.
Absolutely.
You went on to work at Strange Ways as well, is that right? In terms of the various protests that happened at Strange Ways previously?
What it was, obviously I'd been trained in mental health and understanding what might be going on for people who were aggressive, anxious, violent. And so it just happened that one day I was in Lewis's store and a guy climbed out of a window onto the roof. He'd been caught shoplifting and he was going to jump off the roof. I climbed out of another window further around the building, pretended I had no idea what he was doing there, and walked around and said, "Hey, you're all right, mate, watch it there," and got into conversation. And long and short of it was, the police turned up, the fire brigade came, but every time anyone else approached him, he was going to go. He was going to the edge. And what I did was basically bring him back from the edge, talked him down. So that led me to getting a guided tour and being taken to dinner by a senior police officer. Years go by, I've set up the Life Share Project, working on the streets with the homeless. We're doing tea breaks with women forced into sexual activity, and we're having conversations about exit strategies, and you can imagine. And the Strange Wage Riots took place in April 1990. My outreach team came back and told me there are lots of people around the prison who are really in a state. What had happened was the Manchester Evening News had published a headline that there were 20 dead, and the reason they believed that, and they did believe it, was that the prisoners organising the riot had used the resuscitation dummies, the tailor shop dummies. They'd laid them strategically around the prison, totally getting the only way that people could find out what was going on was with fibre optics, camera technology, which was the state of the art then. I was walking around the prison trying to assess the situation, and I bumped into Farida Anderson from Partners of Prisoners. I phoned the Bishop of Salford, which is the Catholic bishop, and I phoned the Bishop of Manchester, the Anglican bishop, and I said, "Look, this is the situation. I need a building close to the prison that I can use as a base of operations to help the people who are being traumatised." They both responded, but it was the Bishop of Manchester who got back with the church, which he persuaded the congregation to move out until the situation was over. Social services came in, probation were involved because they were, they had the list of who was in the prison. What we discovered was the prisoners who were being bussed out were swapping the names and numbers to confuse the authorities. The reaction of the families was, "I don't know where he is. No one can tell me where my Joe, my John, whoever is. Therefore, he's among the dead." So clearly we needed to get into a situation where we could, on behalf of the families, have conversations with the prisoners. And so we became a negotiating team. Tried to piece things together, and slowly we were able to, you know, send families off, right, your Joe's here, and the tension was coming down. I mean, the reason I mentioned the guy on the roof is because I remember a young girl, she was just 16, and she was in a terrible state because her boyfriend, and I think she'd only known him, was on the roof, and he was a remand prisoner, and there were a lot of kids involved in the situation who'd not been found guilty of anything. They were on remand, and she was absolutely terrified that something terrible were going to happen to him. And I shouted to a boyfriend, as I did, this inspector who was nearby signalled to the police cars, and they all put the sirens on to drown a voice out. And then in the end, she turned and she ran to this inspector. And she said, "You must be a dad. You must be someone who loves someone. All I want to do." And a big tear trickled down his face. And the humanity, that interspecial empathy that I'd discovered with the apes kicked in. And he just signalled with his baton and everything went quiet. She talked to her boyfriend. We met him. as he came down, and he was obviously taken into custody, but she knew he was safe then. And it was little things like that going on all the time. That was a massive lesson that I don't think would have evolved as much without the apes.
That's a good way to bring it back around. So just to sign off then, David, where can we hear more about the event in August, I suppose? And, if you can give us a bit of detail about that.
It'll be all over Facebook. I'm not very good with social media per se. Some kids, I was doing the lighting the beacon, the People's Beacon at Tommy Todd for the 80th anniversary of D-Day, and some young people come running over all excited. They wanted to get high fives off veterans and one thing and another. They're saying to me, oh, which war were you in? Oh, I was with Napoleon at Waterloo. Oh, what was that like? And you know, just having, and then they went, will you do a TikTok with us? And I thought, what's a TikTok? And I still don't know. So I said, is it like a clock? And they went, hang on. They got the phone. So all the kids were stood near me doing this, you know, clock thing. And so I don't know how that ended up. But that kind of intergenerational connection, that mutual regard for the well-being of, that is so wonderful to see and to feel and to be part of. So it'll be on Facebook. It will be no doubt on posters. It'll be passed on word of mouth. I'll be drumming it up on my radio show closer to the event. And people will know. But basically, it's if people think Abraham Moss and can get to Abraham Moss, where the college has allowed us to use their car park for the event, everything will be signposted. If they're looking for the Vikings, they'll hear the clash of steel. They'll see the cooking fires. You know, they'll go and they'll find them, and there'll be other signposts to where all the boxing booths, the wrestling and all of that is going on. It'll be a bit like Bellevue itself. It was, you know, if you didn't know the place really well, you just found yourself wandering around in this, you know, like Alice in Wonderland, going, ooh, what's that? And finding that, you know, there was a little village people seemed to forget. There was just all sorts of things.
So hopefully that event will be a great opportunity for people to reminisce and remember some of their favourite memories, I suppose, and experiences through Bellevue.
Absolutely.
In terms of Yellow Jigsaw, thanks again for listening to the Talking About My Generation podcast. If you are somebody who has lots of memories of Bellevue, which I'm sure you are, there's plenty of articles on Talking About My Generation's website around memories of Bellevue. Of course, Remembering Bellevue is a really popular Facebook page if you want to check that out too. And thanks again for listening, and make sure you listen to other podcasts from Talking About My Generation and Yellow Jigsaw. I've been Christian Allen, and thanks again. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to our latest edition of the Changing the Record podcast. For all previous episodes and for the latest news, views and nostalgia for Greater Manchester, check out our website talkingaboutmygeneration.co.uk.